the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see. No, I won't be afraid. No, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday morning. It is the 12th of October. We are coming to you an hour early. NPR will be covering the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings of Amy Coney Barrett coming up at 9 o'clock, which gives us this hour together to do our panel. And we're very excited to have you with us. Let me introduce the group and we'll get started. Panel at WAMC.org if you'd like to throw in a letter or two. No, just one, actually. We don't want more than one. Just one. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Joe, and thank you so much for arranging this ersatz panel. It's terrific.
I like that word, ersatz.
It may not be the right word, but in any case, thanks for doing it.
Thank you very much. Let's see. We also have... I got to check my rundown. We also have Jim Ketterer with us, Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Senior Fellow and Dean of the School of Continuing Education at the American University in Cairo. Good morning, Jim Ketterer. How are you?
Good morning. I'm feeling very ersatz this morning.
Yes. to use it in a sentence, I'm drinking like ersatz coffee. Not really coffee, but kind of like a substitute. Good morning.
That's me.
Yes. Good morning to you, Jim. Libby Post is here, political consultant. Hello, Libby. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, thank you.
Very nice. Early.
I know. It's weird.
Early.
It's weird.
This is not early.
It's weird what an hour does, though, isn't it? It's strange. It's like when the clocks go forward or back. It just is different. That's all. Not horrible. It's just different.
And that's happening soon too.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. That'll just
be
a few
weeks. Alan, you've been up since 4 or 3 or whatever.
Actually, I've been up since 2 o'clock this morning. David Gustina gets up very early too, and I know Joe gets up very early.
Not too.
You know, so the malingerers, you know, they're to be mistrusted.
Yeah. Oh, to be mistrusted. There you go. Well, we have our next guest is no malingerer. Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic, Sarah Rogerson. Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well.
Excellent.
Glad to be here.
We also welcome back our good friend, Dr. Jim Fagan, an immunologist who's been helping out with many of the health questions on our program over the last week or so as the president got the diagnosis of COVID-19, the coronavirus. So we've been having Jim join us and try to get some answers to many questions, and we'll do that today. Again, so good morning, Dr. Fagan. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm fine, thanks.
Very nice to have you here as always. So, the president over the weekend held a rally, whatever it was, on the South Lawn of the White House, and then he said that he will be back on the trail today. He also tweeted on Sunday that he is immune to the novel coronavirus and can't give it, even though the White House has not released any negative test results, and immunity to the virus remains poorly understood. The tweet was flagged by Twitter, who said it contained misleading and potentially harmful misinformation related to the coronavirus. It was the latest example of the social media giant pushing back against the president's post on the deadly virus, and it appeared to refer to Trump's claim to immunity. Some recovered patients with COVID-19, the disease caused by the virus, have been reinfected, and experts say many questions remain about immunity, including how long it lasts. A total and complete sign-off from the White House doctors yesterday, Trump said, "That means I can't get it." quote unquote, immune, or in parentheses, and can't give it. Very nice to know. All right. Dr. Fagan, is that nice to know? Should we feel greatly calmed by that statement?
Well, it would be nice to know if it were true, but unfortunately, we don't have that information yet. I think the likelihood is that people who get infected with COVID-19 will develop an immunity to this virus. How long that immunity will last, we don't know. That's going to take time to tell. So we don't really have that information. We also have no information that absolutely concludes that Donald Trump is no longer contagious. I would certainly like to see the results of a COVID-19 diagnostic test, and I have no idea why the White House wouldn't release that information. You would think that they would. That's something that they would want us to know.
I have a good idea.
The immunity issue is something that is going to be important. You know, we have had experience with other coronaviruses, and the likelihood is that with this novel virus, that individuals who got infected will remain immune. But again, we have to wait and see. You know, how long that immunity will last. Is the immunity present in every individual? Are there factors relating to an individual's immune responsiveness that may determine that immunity? So there are a lot of open questions, and it was absolutely incorrect for the President of the United States to publicly state that he is now immune to this infection.
It seems like one of the big problems here is that if the President, let's say the President gets sick or has bad symptoms tomorrow, then it's not that he got reinfected, it's that he never got over the first bout, right? I mean, he hasn't gone through complete.
Correct. And the problem, one of the problems with this coronavirus, this COVID-19, actually has to do with the immune response. The infection can be lethal, and certainly has in many individuals, as we know. But there's also an inflammatory post-infectious response to this virus that can also be very debilitating and lethal in certain circumstances. And that's, you know, what we call the cytokine storm or the post-infectious inflammatory or immune response. And that can begin on day 10, 11, 12. And so I don't think that he is necessarily out of the woods yet. We have to wait and see, you know, what happens with this. Hopefully, you know, that won't develop. But I certainly would not say that he's now cured and immune and can go on with business. That you cannot say.
But Joe and Jim, I have a question for you guys. The big issue is we still don't know when he got it. His doctor is not saying he's over it. His doctor is saying he's not infectious anymore, but he's not saying that he's out of the woods. You know, I have ethical problems with this doctor from the very beginning, but now I really do. Jim?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that you know, it certainly would be very helpful to know exactly where and when he got infected so that we could do the math. I mean, in terms of transmissibility, most individuals who contract COVID-19 are no longer contagious after 10 days of, it's less likely that they're contagious after 10 days. You cannot make a definitive statement saying, oh, 10 days after the onset of illness, you can do what you want because you're absolutely no longer contagious. Every individual is different, and there are some individuals who may continue to shed active virus. We know that transmission can also begin 2 to 3 days prior to the onset of symptoms. You know, and so he may have been spreading the infection before he knew about the diagnosis. So there are a lot of unanswered questions, and I think that it would be helpful to all of us in this country if the administration would be more transparent. And for the life of me, I can't understand why they would not want to get that information out.
You had a theory, Alan?
Yeah, my theory is they don't want to get the information out because they know that this president, one way or the other, has done something awful. He may have spread it too early. He may be still spreading it because he and his doctors aren't telling us the truth about when he got it and the rest of it. Why? What's so bad about saying he's tested negative from day what and to until now? That is the problem. And I have to say that I don't expect you to stick up for your fellow doctor, Jim, but I can say this guy is really causing me great problems in terms of his ethics.
Yeah, Alan, I totally agree. We've had this discussion before, and I can only imagine he must have been told directly by the President of the United States that you're not allowed to give out any information. Why is that? Who knows? But you're absolutely right. I mean, it makes absolutely no sense why there's not more honesty and openness and transparency. And what I would like to hear is that Donald Trump tested negative and then had another, a repeat COVID-19 diagnostic test, another PCR test 24 hours later, and again was negative. That's what you really want to see. You want to see two negative PCR tests at least 24 hours apart, and that's where we feel comfortable saying that that individual is no longer contagious.
So with the information that we have, the question at hand here before we go to our first break is, was the event on Sunday safe? Are the planned events for this week, the three planned events in swing states, safe?
Well, you know, it's not safe if you don't engage in wearing masks and in social distancing. And by the way, wearing a mask doesn't mean you don't have to social distance. You should be doing both. I mean, we should be doing anything and everything we can to limit the spread of this infection. My understanding was that Donald Trump, this rally on Sunday, that he was standing on a balcony. I don't know how far he was from the crowd. We do know that this virus can become aerosolized, which is different than just forming droplets. And when it's aerosolized, it can travel for a much greater distance and can stay in the air for a much longer period of time. So it's more infectious.
And we know part of that because of what happened in the Rose Garden ceremony
a
week ago. Yeah. Let's pause. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a wonderful panel. Dr. Jim Fagan is with us. Of course, Alan Chartok, Jim Ketterer, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson. We'll be right back after this.
Support for WAMC comes from MVP Healthcare, offering telemedicine for everything from 24/7 urgent care to mental health support. Information at mvphealthcare.com. From Berkshire Money Management, helping individuals figure out what enough looks like for them now and in the future. BerkshireMM.com for details. From Berkshire Center for Weight Loss Surgery, with a focus on life skills and support for long-term success, with sleeve gastrectomy and gastric bypass surgery. Monthly seminars open to the public. 413-395-7510 for registration. And from Northshire Bookstore, independent and family-owned, stocked and ready for early holiday shopping, both in-store and online. Northshire.com.
Changed. A crowd of people stood and stared.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our special edition of the panel this morning, going to 9 o'clock when NPR coverage will take over of the Judiciary Committee hearings of Amy Coney Barrett. There we go. And that happening at 9 o'clock this morning. On our panel this morning, Alan Chartok, Jim Ketterer, Libby Post, Sarah Rogerson, and Dr. Jim Fagan. Any questions from any of our panelists this morning for the doctor before he goes in a few moments? A deep sigh? No.
No, but we want to thank him. We want to thank him for his brilliance in being with us these days, because really we need expert answers, and Jim's had them. So thank you, Jim.
You know, one of the things that I have a question about is that it, and I know this is Pollyannish of me, but this all happens as the president is saying we have a cure and that it's all better and it's going to magically go away. And he's still saying that. In fact, he's saying it more than ever. And the last numbers I saw were 50,000 new cases. We haven't seen numbers like that for months. The middle part of this country is on fire with hotspots. And we're seeing clusters all over the country. So this, let's put aside the actual events, just the message that's being communicated at a time when other countries are starting to again shut down parts of their economy. This is a very bad time for this country.
Well, you know, certainly. It certainly is, and we don't even have evidence that the first wave, was terminated, and now we're in the second wave. I think we're still in the first wave. If you look back and look specifically at some of the institutions in our country that were sort of designed to protect us, I have real concerns in what's going on. We know in May, for example, the CDC released considerations for opening schools in the fall. And they actually developed a decision tool that would guide school systems in deciding when schools could safely be reopened. And they developed a checklist for school administrators with policies and procedures and supplies and facilities and on education training and the like. In July, President Trump had a meeting at the White House, with a school administrators and teachers and students, the following day, he expressed concern about the practicality of guidelines and the expenses associated with following the guidelines that the CDC had developed. And later that day, the same day, Vice President Pence announced that the CDC would be revising the guidelines. And so this decision really raises real concern about the response to, what is the most critical public health emergency during our lifetimes. If you look at the history of these amazing institutions, the CDC, the NIH, the FDA, the FDA was established on June 30th, 1906. The National Institutes of Health was established in August of 1937, and the CDC in July of 1946. These institutions have been around for a while, and they were established with the purpose of promoting and safeguarding the health and well-being of the people of the United States of America. They were never designed to be political tools of a sitting president. And these institutions are dedicated to keeping us safe through the advancement of medical science that has been validated and vetted, and they accomplish this through honesty, integrity, and transparency. And I got to tell you, Joe, I am really concerned about how the Trump administration has tarnished the reputation of these stalwart institutions and the impact that will have on the health and well-being of all Americans. I think this is a real concern.
I want to touch on the new Trump campaign ad that features Dr. Anthony Fauci, who has the clip of the president saying, or has Anthony Fauci saying that the president tackled the virus head on as leaders should. And now Dr. Fauci has come out in a statement and said, in my nearly 5 decades of public service, I have never publicly endorsed any political candidate. The comments attributed to me without permission in the GOP campaign ad were taken out of context from a broad statement I made months ago about the efforts of federal public health officials. Watching the ad, of course, it includes a clip of Fauci speaking during an interview with Mark Levin of Fox News, in which Levin asked Fauci about the coordinated response of the Trump administration. But this was taken out of context, and the ad is an odd one because it's using Fauci as sort of the gold standard to say, see, he's fine, even though they have gone months denigrating him and casting him aside, which I don't quite understand if that works, Alan.
I think it's pretty easy to understand, Joe, and I think you get it also, of course. And that is that Fauci is immensely popular in this country, and Trump is not. So they look at the polls and they say, okay, we'll have some of that. And they include Fauci in surreptitiously, figuring that since he works in the federal government, he won't fight back. But we know our Fauci, and he has done it, and he has been quite plain about this. So I hate it, by the way, when anybody says that they've been taken out of context, because usually, you know, that's a lie. In this case, it happens to be true. But unfortunately, when you hear somebody say it was taken out of context, you get suspicious. However, we all know about Fauci and how wonderful he's been. He's just gotten every award you could possibly get.
Absolutely.
Well, this was said months ago. Yeah. Libby. Yeah.
Well, what they've done, I mean, you know, people in my business, some of us get a bad name just from waking up in the morning and thinking the thoughts that we think. But this really does undermine the credibility of the folks who try to be truthful in doing the kind of work that we do. I mean, and if anybody thinks that Anthony Fauci would endorse Donald Trump, then they deserve another 4 years of Donald Trump. I mean, you know, how stupid can you be to think that this is true? And I'm sure, you know, his base will use this and say, look, you know, Dr. Fauci even thinks he's doing a great job. But any thinking individual who has been watching what's been going on for the last year now, almost a year, knows that it's impossible that Fauci has a spine as strong as steel and as resolute, and he would never, ever endorse a political candidate because he understands, you know, it's what the doctor was talking about before, this politicization of the CDC and NIH and science in itself. That's something that Fauci has pushed back against his entire professional life. And so while, you know, he's had to play sort of the game in order to protect public health, the idea that he would endorse Trump is laughable. But the idea that the Trump campaign would use that quote is dangerous. It's just simply dangerous.
Jim Ketterer.
You know, I've resisted the idea all along during this crisis that one point or another that Fauci should resign in protest, and though people have called for him to do so. But this might be a moment to reconsider that, for him to say, you know, I've had a long career in government service. This is an outrageous use of my name and my words. You know, I simply won't stand for it, and I'm going to resign, and then have him find some other post. I'm sure many places would love to have him on board great research universities, and from that platform, then speak his mind.
See, I disagree. I really do disagree because I think, and I've said it again and again, as an insider, he has a credibility that is very important, and the news media cannot ignore it. He gets listened to. You know, I think it would be a big mistake. Look at all the guys, the Joint Chiefs, the head of the Joint Chiefs and everybody else who are yelling and screaming, and it's as if they're, you know, in a void. No, I think he has to stay.
But yeah, Alan, I think those examples are exactly the ones I'm thinking of, you know, General Mattis, General McMaster, General Kelly, all of them, they eventually started to speak up. But when they left quietly and really not saying a thing about what they really thought. And I think if he, at this moment, right before the election, if he resigned and really spoke his mind, I think it would be an important moment, not just in the election, but in what Dr. Fagan was talking about before, too, in protecting the legitimacy of our institutions.
Dr. Fagan?
That's what makes an argument.
Yeah. You know, I think it's important to remember what Tony Fauci does. His job is not to be on Donald Trump's team. His job is the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease. And that is an incredibly important institute in NIH. And he's involved with a lot of things other than COVID-19. And, I understand where you're coming from, Jim. And I understand that, you know, that the feeling that, you know, he just, you know, shrug his shoulders and walk away from this. But I think it's important. I personally think he's not going to do that. I think it's important that he stay. He does incredible work in the NIH, and hopefully he will continue to do that.
Sarah Rogerson, let's go to you before we go to a break.
I think the Trump administration and the Republican Party in general is making an error in this election term and relying on what worked last time, which is Facebook and these little bites and clips, because what the American people have done and what the Democrats have done is to respond to what happened last election, learn about it, and take a different approach to getting people the correct information. And so I, you know, maybe I'm being naive too, but I feel there's a change in how we're receiving information, and they're increasingly, their messages, like this ad, are so off the mark that they're only going to hit their base, which is dwindling every single time Pete Buttigieg jumps on Fox News.
Mm. let's take a break. Dr. Fagan, I want to thank you very much for being with us. It's a great pleasure to have you on the program once again, and you're so helpful in answering these questions. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you very much, Joe. It's a pleasure for me to be here.
Be well. We have about 28 minutes left before we go over to NPR coverage. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue with the rest of our panel right after this. Listening to the music of John Lennon this morning, who would have turned 80 years old over the weekend, and we remember him this morning through his music. We have it all posted on our playlist, wamc.org/roundtable. Welcome back to our special panel this morning, going from 8 to 9. We'll be doing this tomorrow and Wednesday as well as we continue covering the hearings, which will beginning at 9 o'clock this morning, NPR coverage of the hearings for the nominee for the Supreme Court, Amy Coney Barrett. So let's talk about what we should expect from those hearings. Alan, and then I'll go to Sarah.
Well, I do think that, you know, the Democrats are going to come prepared. There are those people who think no Democrat should even walk in because it's preordained. But I think you never know. And if it gets really tough, and if she gets caught up in some verbiage, and if the whole court question gets asked now about the way in which it's all being railroaded, you might get a substantial change. Look, right now it looks like she'll be approved, but we've seen instances where the most carefully laid plans, including what we are seeing here, go awry, and I think that may happen here.
Sarah Rogerson.
Well, I think all eyes are on Kamala Harris as well, yep. Who, of course, is a member of this committee and will be presiding over the hearings. It's going to be very interesting to see what role the Democrats decide she'll play, because she very much can't act on her own anymore, at least not for the next 26 days. I mean, she's sort of known for being an independent voice, sort of being the hard, you know, she made Kavanaugh cry, right? That's like the one of the things that she's known for. And that tactic won't work this time. You know, she'll be seen as a mean girl. There's, of course, racial dynamics at play there in that perception. So it's going to be interesting to watch, you know, how she comports herself, because it may be a chance to take a glimpse into how she might, you know, act in the role of vice president with these additional pressures.
You said presiding over. You didn't mean that, right? Because Lindsey Graham
not
is
presiding.
Going to be
presiding.
Yeah, yeah.
Correct. Yeah. I just think of everybody on the dais as sort of like collectively presiding, but right, correct. She's not
you're,
in the
you're
seat
exactly
of,
right.
of,
sure.
of presiding. Thank you for that, Alan. But But other than that, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how the New York Times had an article, I believe it was yesterday, about the new conservatism that she represents. And so if the Democrats come prepared and if they do their job, they'll have direct quotes from her speeches, from her decisions, from her from any scholarship that she's produced. And she's going to have to stand by it. And it will be interesting to see if this is going to be another confirmation hearing theater where a lot of things are deferred and the quote that everyone says, right? Like stare decisis, I will abide by the prior opinions of this court. If that's just going to be the functional equivalent of taking the Fifth Amendment in Supreme Court hearings. So we'll see what happens. It'll be interesting. It'll be a little bit of a break of this in the news stream of I don't want to say a break in the negativity, but a little bit more of an intellectual bit of news. And for that reason, I worry it's going to sort of get swallowed up in whatever happens in 3 hours, because who even knows these days?
But Lindsey Graham has a lot to lose here, doesn't he? I mean, he's in a very tough race himself. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, yeah. Speaking of, so he's in a fight for his future and faces a lot of competition for his own seat. So I think he has to play the middle too. He has to behave himself, in short, because if he tries to slip in sort of, you know, he has that slippery tongue where he tends to be able to make the news on these like really kind of outrageous claims disguised as questions. And it'll be interesting to see whether or not he's able to get away with that this time around.
Will you post?
Well, I heard yesterday as I was driving up to Saratoga, I think, and I was listening to you guys, she made some statement about judges shouldn't be making policy. And I'm sorry, but there is such a distinct relationship between the law and policy, that when you change a law or you make a decision about a law, you are affecting policy. And so I think, you know, I think that that's a, a great way to put some cover on it and for her supporters to say, see, she's not going to create policy. She's just going to stick to interpreting the law. Well, that's lovely. It's just that one does impact the other, and it goes both ways. Policy impacts law, and law impacts policy. And, you know, saying, oh, well, we're going to, you know, the upholding of the court decisions of the past. You know, that's like Brett Kavanaugh saying abortion is a matter of settled law. It's settled until it's not. Right. And we all know that Roe v. Wade is under threat. And now Alito and Clarence Thomas came out last week saying we should revisit marriage equality and strike that decision down. So I have no faith if this woman becomes a Supreme Court justice that the decisions that had been done are going to be upheld. You know, I mean, it's just not going to happen. And that's why we need to do everything we need to do to stop this nomination. Whether we'll be able to do that or not still remains to be seen. But let's not forget, we did stop Robert Bork, you know, Ronald Reagan's nominee to the Supreme Court, because, you know, I know it was a different time and bipartisanship was still something that was going on. And you had pro-choice Republicans back then. So we'll, you know, there has been precedent for doing this, and we just have to keep the pressure up. But don't anyone think just because her rhetoric is, oh, judges shouldn't set policy, that doesn't mean that that's not what's going to happen.
Jim Ketter.
I also think it's interesting how this is going to intersect with the politics of Catholics in the United States. And in this presidential election, we have Joe Biden at the head of the ticket on the Democratic side, who's a practicing Catholic. 22% of Americans identify in one way or another as Catholic. And Trump won the Catholic vote in 2016, but just barely. And we've seen recently Secretary of State Mike Pompeo feuding with Pope Francis, and the Pope refusing to see him when he made a trip to Italy. And I think that the Democrats are going to have to tread a, you know, very fine line on questioning the nominee on these various issues that others have just brought up, but also not appear to be going after her Catholicism.
And from my understanding, if she is seated on the court, it would be 6-3 Catholic, right? Which is not the first time that's happened, but that would be the number.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure the count, but you know, and she went to Notre Dame Law School and taught there. And I just think that is one of the things kind of bubbling just beneath the surface on this.
We talked about Jamie Harrison briefly, and I just, before we go to the break, this story has been bandied about here and made quite a bit of, because it's astonishing, but he made raised $57 million. It's the most ever made in a period by a Senate candidate. It beat the record of Beto O'Rourke, which isn't a great example because he lost. But $57 million is a lot of money. We'll take a break.
I would just go ahead. Very, very quickly, I would say, you know, somewhat sarcastically, that he didn't raise it. Lindsey Graham raised it.
That's exactly right.
That guy.
That's right.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation, and we'll bring you up to the top of the hour when the hearings will begin, and we'll cover those. NPR will cover those for us. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back right after this.
Nothing you can do, but you can learn how to be you in time.
Our last go-around on this morning's panel, 9 o'clock, we'll be going over to NPR coverage of the Amy Coney Barrett hearings. We have with us Alan Chartok, Libby Post, Jim Ketterer, and Sarah Rogerson. A lot of really good letters from listeners, and I hope we get to at least most of them. Here we go. John writes and says, the Times reported that some Democrats have expressed concern that the 87-year-old Senator Dianne Feinstein, the ranking committee member, might not be up to the task. Please discuss panel. Very interesting article.
Well, I read that, too. It sounds kind of ageist to me. You know, if she shows, I think everybody should be judged by what they do, not by their age. I say that somewhat self-seekingly, of course, but that's just the way it is.
Sarah?
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, look at what just happened. You know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg stayed in her seat and did the work that she did until she literally couldn't do it anymore. I read through parts of that article. I honestly couldn't get all of the way through it. And I think this is sort of an example, or definitely an example, of a problem that we have with even mainstream journalism and gender roles. It's probably definitely not the first time she's faced these types of these and many other types of questions about her competence in the workplace.
Right.
And certainly won't be the last.
Because, Libby, I kept on looking for something that was like the smoking gun of, oh, this happened and this should have great concern. But they really didn't have that. It was just the age.
Well, yeah, I don't think there is anything. She hasn't faltered. She hasn't. I mean, are her politics perfectly to the progressive side? Not always, but that doesn't mean that she's not capable of doing the job, and she's a good Democrat. And she'll be able to stand up to the, I mean, she stood up to the pressure for a very long time. You know, we have to remember this woman also has a backbone of steel and has done amazing work. And so I do think it's, you know, oh, she's too old. Well, you know, did they say that about Strom Thurmond? I don't think so. Did they say that about Jesse Helms? I don't think so. They just say it about women. And it's just typical sexist crap.
I think you forgot Robert Byrd. Okay.
Him too. They didn't say it about him either.
Well, look, everybody has a chance to do it their own way. The New York Times does it a little bit differently, which is that, you know, the Sulzbergers step aside, the next one comes on, then the next one comes on, then the next one comes on. That's just the way they do it. Good for them. They have every right to do it the way they want to. You know, for many people of an advanced age, why kick them in the rear?
We get this letter from Sergia, who says, please explain to me why even one Democratic senator would agree to attend the Judicial Committee hearings for this nominee. Two Democratic senators need to attend to have a quorum for the Judicial Committee meeting. No Democrats, no meeting. If it were a Democratic president, the Republicans would refuse to meet, like they did with Merrick Garland. Why don't the Democrats just say no? Do they lack a backbone?
Well, we've talked about this. This is a golden opportunity. The only way this is really going to be stopped is when people decide that they're hearing enough to make them, you know, throw up. And it's up to the Democrats to make that happen. Nor do I think they would get everybody to agree to this thing. Mm. I get the letter, but that isn't going to happen. The real question to me is whether they'll expand the court if Joe Biden wins and the Senate goes Democratic. And there, I've always been opposed to that. Roosevelt found out the hard way that it wasn't a good thing to have happen. Nevertheless, because they've behaved so abysmally, the Republicans, saying one thing about, you know, a year out, we can't consider this within a year of the election, now within days of the election, I think maybe it's justified at this stage of the game if they're going to play the game that way.
We go to
say on that issue, I think on not showing up and not producing a quorum, I'm not sure that that kind of, you know, show would play well for the Democrats in the election, to just appear to be obstructionist. Right. While it might be effective in one way, I think it might also be counterproductive. And on the court issue, expanding the court, packing the court, whatever term you're going to use, I think also, you know, the Biden team must be getting polling data that shows that that's just not a winning issue, and that he's, you know, he's taking the non-position that he is, has to be based on something. And I think while it appeals to a certain segment of the Democratic Party, I don't think that's a probably a winning strategy either.
By the way, I completely agree. However, once they're in office, I don't agree. And I think that based on the fact that this country is now facing, which is just completely just wrong, a 6-3 conservative majority on that Supreme Court, I think it's disgusting, and I think that the way that they've done it is disgusting, and I think it's got a lot of revulsion. And I think if Joe Biden gets elected president, we may see a change.
Kathy writes to us and says, "Good morning. Why can't citizens ask questions of the nominee?" Oh, they don't want to hear from you, Kathy.
Another why can't question. It's great.
Yeah, it'd be a good idea.
Well, technically, citizens are asking questions, right? Isn't that the idea of a representative democracy? So
yes.
Send them to your senator and see what happens.
See what happens. That's right.
Representative.
Mike says revealing Donald Trump's actual infection date would reveal Trump's attempt to kill Biden by infecting him with the COVID-19 at the debate. If the doctors knew he was infected and did not quarantine him, then they are complicit. As Alan stresses, says Nicholas, 45 is a lying liar. Who has medical doctors at a hospital sign NDAs except someone who is trying to hide something? This person corrupts everything and everyone he touches. He has been gaslit. He has been being gaslit for over 4 years. I am also intrigued that the drugs used for his miracle cure were made from aborted fetal tissue. The hypocrisy of this idiot knows no bounds. Yeah, we haven't really talked about that one yet.
Well, the letter writer talked about it, and he's right, or she's right. It's exactly right. I'm against it until it's convenient for me.
The only thing I would correct about that letter is this behavior is not just 4 years from Donald Trump. It's the way that he's behaved for a long time, and he learned at the side of Roy Cohn, and this is standard operating procedure for him for decades.
Libby?
Well, you know, the duplicity of them using, I mean, look, Regeneron is doing great work, and I'm not faulting them at all, okay? I think what they're doing is great, and, you know, they're a Capital Region company, and they are bringing a lot of in Yiddish, it's naches, but, you know, we're proud about the fact that they're here and they're doing this great work. You know, but I do think that this shows how duplicitous and self-serving the Republicans are. Here they are nominating a woman who thinks women should be subservient and submit to their husband, who is clearly anti-choice, who is against using, stem cells from fetuses for research. It's part of the whole of her whole background. And yet they're all cheering the fact that that ostensibly Trump is feeling better, which I tend to doubt, and they've used fetal tissue to do this. And nobody is saying a word. They're all it's like all the guys on K Street, all the anti-abortion guys on K Street, or the legislators who live, you know, in Washington, who knock up their girlfriends and demand that they get an abortion and yet vote against abortion rights. It's just the typical two-sided, two-facedness of the Republican Party.
Sarah Rogerson, we have about a minute.
I was going to say exactly what Libby said. So the only thing that I'll point out is that it's not just Amy Coney Barrett's faith. It's her, what the New York Times and this organization that she's a part of calls ecstatic traditions of charismatic Christianity. Yeah. We're not just talking
it's
about
a little scary.
Yeah. What does that even mean?
it, it's you know, sort of the new Christianity, the born again vibe, you know, that you sort of like fall out for Jesus.
Well, it's going to be interesting as I watch the monitor. The senators are at their desks, and I believe the nominee is making her way to her position. So we're going to end and go over to NPR coverage. Thank you so much for being with us this morning. Alan, thank you very much.
Thanks, Joe.
Jim Ketterer, Libby Post, Sarah Rogerson, of course, to Dr. Jim Fagan for being with us earlier. Again, the hearings will run the better part of the day. We'll be in and out of them as the schedule allows. We'll be back tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock for another one-hour panel prior to tomorrow's edition of the hearings. Now we turn it over to NPR.